Hello.
Hello.
Ooh. Hi, Sunny. Hi.
Hi, Andre.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Actually, okay. Bimbo hours.
Uh-huh.
So this happened to me the other day. I was driving from one part of our state, Wyoming, to another part. And I thought that the I-80 and the I-580 would be, like, the same thing. Or if not the same thing, mm-hmm. they'd be headed in the same direction, so it would be fine. Mm-hmm. That turned out to be completely false. And then I had to turn around, and I had to take, like, the I-80 back, west, I think. And I took east instead. And basically, a drive that should have been maybe an hour the other day took me 3 hours because my phone's GPS is really fucked up. All that to say, I'm doing well. I'm just feeling more directionally impaired than ever. That's my mood.
Wow. You're really giving the term bimbo a good... You're really honoring the term. I mean, you're not even blonde, but hi. listen, I can totally relate, though. I am very also directionally impaired. I don't know if it's a gay thing. I know it's a stereotype, but I'm not going to go there because political correctness. But let me just tell you, I don't know right from left. I'll be inside like a Sears, and I will have entered that store through the main entrance 5 minutes ago, and then I'll be looking at something, and I'll turn around, and I'll want to exit the store, and I'll be like, where did I come in from? And there you have me walking around the Sears for 10 minutes till I finally find the exit, and I'm like, how did it take me this long? So clearly, there's some sort of impairment going on up here. I don't know why it is solely related to just, like, directional things, but it is, and I'm sorry, everybody. That's just how it is.
Yes. But somehow we made our way to this today.
Yeah.
And you know what? We did a significantly better job than the Malaysian Flight 370. So.
Wow, man. What a segue. Hi, all. Welcome to Scary Talk episode 86. Today we're talking about Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. Yeah, I mean, just a straightforward introduction. That's what we're talking about today. Pretty spooky, pretty shitty, and as I was telling Sunny, kind of sad, depending on what you believe happened. And I, especially after, like, obviously I heard about this when it happened, but after doing more research for this episode, I think I have a very cemented opinion on what happened. Mm. So, I got my feelings, yeah.
Interesting, so, okay.
Yep. listen. I'm sure I got some more chatter to give, but this is a long ass talk. There's a lot of information here, so I suggest we just get started.
I definitely feel that.
Yeah, we'll save the bimbo jokes for later. Haha, bimbo, bimbo. So let's do this.
Oh my god, I'm really dumb. Okay. the thing is, maybe I am really dumb. When I first heard the news stories about the Malaysian Airlines flight, I honestly, at the time, did not understand the hype. And maybe that's because I was, at the time, 6 years old, because right now I'm, like, 16.
True. Precisely.
But I was kind of like, okay, so a flight disappeared, you know? Like, I don't know, maybe they ran out of gas over the ocean. What are you going to do? Why is it such a big... Because it was international news for a long time, and it actually prompted one of the most expensive search parties of all time. I don't know. It just surprised me at the time. But obviously, after reading more about it, I can see more.
It was a run-of-the-mill flight through Malaysian Airlines.
Why people think it's such an interesting mystery. And B, of course, why it got so much news attention.
For a five-hour flight. This is a flight that happened all the time at this airport. Daily, actually. So it's meant to be very standard. And the aircraft as well, a Boeing 777, is known for being a pretty safe, dependable aircraft. So it took off at 12:41 a.m. It was supposed to arrive at about 5:40 a.m. However, at 1:07, its last transmission from its plane's communication system was sent, and at 1:19 a.m. there was the last voice check-in heard from. So that means about 40 minutes after takeoff, they received their last communication from the flight. So the last voice communication was the co-pilot saying, stating their location and saying, "All right, good night," which are the standard final words to use when you're changing airspaces, because again, they're headed from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, so at that time they were headed northeast and just breaking through the Vietnam airspace. So again, the plane has been headed on this northeastern route for about 40 minutes out of a 5-hour flight. The last voice check-in happens. And then at 1:21 a.m., the plane's transponder stops communicating, which, as we found out, tends to have to be shut off manually, meaning someone took action for that to be shut off. After that, at about 1:22 a.m., the plane disappeared from Thai military radar. And essentially, around this point, it's now estimated that the plane took a sharp northwesterly turn, if anything, maybe even southwest, sharply away from the route that it was already on. At that point, the plane changes course, and instead of heading in this northeasterly direction, it starts to head outwards towards the Indian Ocean. At this point, essentially over time, they increasingly lose track of the plane, and there's more and more panic from the Malaysian government, essentially. So at 2:15 a.m., there's military radar detection of the plane not being on its route. At 2:40 a.m., Malaysia Airlines says it learns that the plane is missing from its radar. And from 2:40 to 3:45, so that's an hour-long period, Malaysia Airlines did a preliminary search on their own. So as you'll notice, some time has passed, which is also why there's been criticism thrown around from different people here about how early they should have called the search and informed the international community of what was going on here. But at 3:45 a.m., so that is now 3 hours after takeoff and about 2 hours and 20 minutes since the plane changed route, there was a code red alert sent that the plane was missing. At this point, there's a huge search begins to take place, and by 6:30 a.m., this is when the plane was supposed to arrive. Nothing has arrived in China's capital, and at 7:20 a.m., so an hour after it was supposed to arrive, a few hours after it's confirmed to have disappeared, there's a public announcement of the plane's disappearance. So thinking about what happened in the days after that, there's also a bigger timeline to think about days-wise, right? Because the plane took off on March 8th, 2014. I should have started with that, but March 8th, 2014 at 12:41 a.m., and the search became increasingly intensive in the days and weeks following. On March 9th, search operations began over the Gulf of Thailand. An oil slick on the water was seen near where the plane was detected, but eventually they realized that that was not actually from a plane. There's small sort of like blips like this throughout the search where they see something that seems a little interesting and turns out to not be super relevant. On March 10th, they expand their search efforts into the South China Sea. However, of course, they don't find anything. And it's also revealed that two passengers on the flight used stolen passports, which raised some concerns from people saying, what if those two passengers hijacked the plane? However, after some more research, it turns out that the two passengers who had used stolen passports were attempting to find asylum, so it doesn't seem that they had any actual criminal motive to hijack the plane. So after having looked into it, it seemed like there was no link between those two people, at least, and possible hijacking or terrorist efforts. And on March 12th, an investigation into the possibility that Flight 370 was hijacked or sabotaged begins. Thinking more about not just the plane, but who was in it, part of why this became such international news is that it was an international flight, right? So the flight originally took off carrying 227 passengers and 12 crew members, with people from 14 nations. 153 people were Chinese citizens, so the Chinese government was heavily involved in this search. Other passengers included folks from Australia, Canada, France, Hong Kong, India, Indonesia, Iran, the Netherlands, Russia, Taiwan, and Ukraine. And a couple folks from the US as well. So a lot of different countries involved here in this search, and concerned, right? It's really sad to think of this many people disappearing, as Andre mentioned earlier. Eventually they begin to realize, oh, this this flight was not on its correct path. It changed paths due to radar information, satellite information that shows more about where the plane was, and so they moved their search efforts more again to the southwest of where the plane's original route was, and look into the Indian Ocean. The thing with the Indian Ocean is that it is an ocean. It's huge, right? There'd be no way to search the whole Indian Ocean. So even though they had a sort of general area for the plane, there weren't precise enough locations to tell where the plane had crashed. They kind of had to do this like a math problem, using the satellite information, figuring out, oh, okay, here's a range that the plane had to be in. And over time, that range became smaller as more information was revealed. So that's sort of the background on the Malaysian Flight 370. Big, big mystery in terms of why this happened and what happened. And for a little bit of background as well on the pilots, because you'll see why that becomes super relevant later, or I'm sure you know Andre. But there was a pilot and a co-pilot. So the pilot was Captain Zahari Ahmad Shah. He was 53, a veteran pilot who joined Malaysia Airlines in 1981. So he'd been flying for almost 35 years. And he logged 18,000 hours of flying experience. He was a father of three, a passionate cook, a keen fisherman. Several reports have suggested now that his wife and children moved out of the family home the day before the flight, after his wife told him she was leaving him. This is really interesting because other sources say that he had no reason to be depressed or have any mental health issues before this flight. So I'm sure we'll get into that more later, but that is something that's been noted. And this is BBC saying this time. And in terms of what his family has said, his 26-year-old son has quote, ignored all the speculation, saying that he knows his father better than that. And it is a tough situation because there's a lot of suspicion around these pilots, but at least this pilot, Mr. Zahari, he was known as being very professional. He was regarded by younger pilots as being something of a mentor, being a nice guy, being passionate about aviation, even making videos to show off and being a bit of a geek and building his own flight simulator. This is who he was known to be to his colleagues, it seems. So that was the pilot. And the co-pilot, similarly, has a really clean background. Lots of good quotes about who the co-pilot was as well. He was a younger, less experienced pilot, of course, but he had also followed his own path of being promoted through the ranks until he was a co-pilot. And there was also an interesting report that this co-pilot, tried to use his phone to make some kind of phone communication moments after the aircraft had switched routes and sort of vanished. So there's also stuff in the air about, did the co-pilot know something was going on? His phone did not connect, but there is evidence now of an attempt to connect. And what happened there. So that's kind of our background going in.
So, yeah, pretty spooky, mysterious stuff. So, as Sunny mentioned, as the airplane was entering the airspace of Vietnam, it signaled to Ho Chi Minh with something that I believe is called a handshake, which in aviation terms means basically acknowledging that you're entering a space and having the commander of that space acknowledge you back so that the plane can, you know, continue route. And so it did that. It was like, oh, I'm about to enter Ho Chi Minh, flight 370. There are logs of these communications. And then the Ho Chi Minh tower control person, I guess, is like, okay, great, you know, continue forth, enter the space. It's fine. So that happens. And that's the last known communication between the plane and any tower control of any kind. There are logs of other kinds, such as attempted satellite communications, and also one very mysterious iPhone location log that were later revealed to exist. But at the time, this was the only information that authorities were working with, was again the last Ho Chi Minh contact. And so that happens, the plane has no further communication, and then 4 hours after the plane was scheduled to arrive in Beijing, once it doesn't and 4 hours have passed, the plane is officially declared missing. They were obviously trying to contact it before, like during those 4 hours, once it was already supposed to have arrived in Beijing, but they were unsuccessful. 4 hours later, they declared it missing. Something else about contact is that a lot of criticism was also directed by China, was very critical of the way that the Malaysian authorities handled this case, because there wasn't a lot of information released by them very promptly once the flight disappeared, and a lot of them were Chinese citizens, and so China was kind of angry. Well, another criticism that the Malaysian authorities faced was the fact that apparently the Malaysian control tower that the flight had originated from in Kuala Lumpur didn't bother to contact this plane for a couple of hours after its last contact, which there's conflicting things that I've read about whether or not this is standard practice or not. Like, because I do know that the pilot had at one point told the Kuala Lumpur control tower like good night, and so I don't know if Kuala Lumpur was supposed to just like, you know, let him be, leave him alone, like they already said good night. I don't know how that works, but I'm guessing that's not how it works, because again, there was a lot of criticism about the fact that there were hours that passed with no communication attempted between Kuala Lumpur and the plane. So and if there were, maybe, you know, things would have turned out better. I don't know. So basically, they were saying, like, I don't know, the people at the Kuala Lumpur control tower were fucking, you know, like scratching their bellies. Yeah, they were doing, they were just like sitting there doing nothing. That's kind of, yeah. So just yeah. So this is just a couple of interesting points there. Okay, so this plane is fucking gone, right? And it's missing now, officially declared missing. What the fuck do we do? So Malaysia is like, and I oop, and they release a search and rescue effort. That, as Sunny mentioned earlier briefly, when she was kind of covering the general timeline of this case, was initially launched in Southeast Asia. Following initial analysis of communications between the plane and a satellite, however, the search was then moved to the Southern Indian Ocean 1 week after the plane disappeared, because they reanalyzed the data that had available to them at that time, and they were like, I think we're looking in the wrong place, let's switch paths. And so they did, which by what I've read, it makes sense. The satellite communications that they're talking about are basically I watched a very confusing video about this, but basically there's like two ways that that planes can communicate. Some planes have both, some planes only have one way, and this Boeing 777 had both. It could both do like something through radar and also communicate via satellite. So like you have a plane and then you have a satellite up in space, and a plane sends a communication to that satellite, and the satellite sends a communication back to a tower, and then if the tower wants to respond, it's just like satellite TV, for example, right? If the tower wants to respond, it sends a communication to the satellite up in space, and then the satellite sends it back down to the plane. So
totally. And I think that part of their change in search was that Malaysia revealed that they had more information than they had originally revealed. From what I've read, it sounds like in general countries sort of started stepping up with more info, because they were cautious to reveal how much their military radar could actually perceive, because that gives away sort of, I guess, like military information about the countries.
Right. So at the beginning, a number of countries were very hesitant to release some of their own radar information, which apparently had logged this plane flying within it. Like these radars had info about this 370 flight, but they didn't want to release that because of security purposes. national defense shit, but eventually some of them did, and so that helped narrow the now new surface like area that was being done even more. Mm-hmm. And so they were able to narrow the search down to a more specific spot within the Indian Ocean. Still, they didn't find shit. And what happens is this search goes on for close to 3 years. And then in 2017, the official search for this flight ends.
Can I just say, like,
they had spent
amazing. Like, yeah. I don't even have the persistence to find my phone when I've like misplaced it on my bed. I'm like, I'll figure it out in the morning.
They don't hire Bimbo, Sunny. That's why.
I guess not.
That's why they were able to do it.
Being told, like, yeah, we're looking for a flight that, or like a plane that fell in the Indian Ocean. We have this range that's, you know, like maybe 1 to 500,000 square miles. We're just gonna check it out. And then being on that mission for 3 years. Oh, you know, it's like, it's basically like going into academia and doing research is what it's looking for something you'll never find.
Basically.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, listen. I mean, there were what? Like, there were 19 vessels. There were 345 sorties, which are like tiny planes. And these were deployed by military aircraft that searched over 4.6 million square kilometers. And so they searched. They searched. I remember reading that at the beginning, the way they had, like, once they decided to reroute to the Indian Ocean from Southeast Asia, the way they had initially, before the satellite communications shit, initially hone in on like what range to search in was through like 7 scope rings. If you can imagine like the Earth, like a globe, and then where the Indian Ocean is, you put like a circle, and then there's like 6 more slightly bigger each than the other circles surrounding that initial circle. And those were 7 rings, right? 7 kind of like circles of search scope that they determined by radar. And so they were like, this is where we should search. But again, like if one of these circles circled like, I don't know, like Thailand and Vietnam, by the time you get to the 7th circle, right, the biggest circle in the set of rings, that circle circled way more. And so it wasn't a lot of help. Like these circles initially didn't help narrow the search very much. And that's why when they got a hold of these satellite communications, they were like, ah, yes, now we can narrow it down more. And they did. But again, 3 years later and millions of dollars later, the Malaysian government and the Australian government and the Chinese government were like, we done. However, in January of 2018, Sunny also mentioned this, there was an American marine exploration company called Ocean Infinity that resumed the search for the plane and narrowed it down to 25,000 square kilometers, which is exponentially smaller than the initial search. But they also came up with nothing. They were also focusing on the Indian Ocean, but they came up with nothing. 6 months later, they were like, we're also done with this search. But I mean, that's still kind of cool and kind of brings hope. The fact that because this plane disappearance garnered so much attention, 4 years after its disappearance, over 4 years after its disappearance, there were still searches for it. And as a matter of fact, there's a rumored search that is set to restart soon, maybe, potentially, by the US again. So I hope so. I mean, I hope that happens. I would understand if it didn't, though, because even with all the attention it garnered, by this point, 6 years later, I feel like the thing has kind of died down and people have just assumed the most logical conclusion, which is that the plane crashed and everyone is dead. Not that it's like being held captive in some country or I don't know. I read theories like that, but to me, those don't make sense because like the cargo wasn't valuable. The passengers were like normal people. So anyway.
No, totally. It's just tough because now that it's been so long, I very seriously doubt there are any survivors. So I guess that makes sense for the first year or two that you want to search in case, but, you know, mm-hmm. we have rubble showing up everywhere.
Right, like, if you're thinking about survivors, like, in the actual ocean, it's not even the first year, girl. It's, like, the first week. Totally. That's all you got. I mean, it's more that it's stopped now due to not even survivors, but they don't even think they can find a lot of this rubble, because by this point, this plane has probably disintegrated. So if it isn't stuck in one place, which is what some people think, like kind of how the Titanic is, if it's not that, then it's disintegrated into a million pieces of rubble, and they're never going to piece that shit together. So they're like, you know what,
totally,
we give up.
Totally.
But I actually go more with the first kind of notion. I think that it is... I wouldn't think this plane would just disintegrate. I think it's at the bottom of the ocean somewhere, like a fucking, you know, like a shipwreck. But we just can't find it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of speculation about, well, were all these searches looking in the wrong place, potentially? And there's some info on that I'll touch on later. But, I mean, how wrong of a place can you be looking in when, again, you've covered, what did I say? 4 million square miles, yeah, or something stupid like that? Yeah, like... I mean, come on.
The anyway. Ocean is a mysterious bitch, honestly.
The ocean really do be big, though.
She really do.
I know. So, now, there was also an underwater search, right? So, I didn't clarify. Well, no, I did clarify. I said that, like, a lot of tiny planes had been sent out to, like, look at the ocean and shit. But there was also, and there were, like, ships that were looking... That were searching the ocean on the surface of the ocean, but there were also submarines that were sent to the seabed to see if they can find anything. And these tiny submarines also covered like a crazy amount of seafloor. What was it, like 120,000 square kilometers, which is definitely less than like 4 million, but it's also way harder to search the seabed. And these submarine thingies are, you know, are like hard to operate, expensive, I'm sure. And so 120,000 square kilometers is what they searched for on the seafloor. They found nothing, not even debris, not even rubble. Can you believe that? Mm-hmm. Like the rubble and debris that has been found washed up on beaches in Southeast Asia and nearby the Indian Ocean and on like an island called Penang, which is like part of Malaysia. So that's pretty crazy. So yeah, there was an underwater search, also nothing. And then the 2018 search that I talked about with Ocean Infinity American Company, which also found nothing. And that's all as far as search. Basically, two big searches, one involving aerial and like regular sea surface and also submarine searches. And then a second one, the American Company one, which used submarines. And nothing. Now, the debris that I mentioned, right? So... in the island of Reunion, which is in the Indian Ocean, there was the flaperon of the plane found, which is part of the inner wing. And this island is part of France. So at this point, the French government was involved. And they, like, analyzed this piece. And they were like, yes, it's part of the plane. And then the search didn't reignite because it was happening back in 2015 when this first piece of debris was found. But it garnered even more interest, and it didn't really change the search scope at all, because they didn't think that because this thing, like this part of debris, had been found in Reunion Island, which isn't like necessarily super close to where they were looking at, not just because that happened they think that they had to search there. Instead, they understood that debris patterns are a thing when like debris and rubble is in the ocean, and they were able to determine that Reunion Island was actually in the debris path. And so it would make sense that rubble would arrive there on its beaches. And so because they knew that, they didn't, like, they were like, yeah, like, we're probably gonna find debris there if we change our search scope, but the actual like whole plane wreck that we're looking for isn't gonna be near Reunion. We still think it's gonna be where we are looking right now, which was like Southern Indian Ocean. But I still wanted to mention this because it is interesting that rubble was found, mostly because so few pieces of rubble have been found. I mean, 3 confirmed pieces and like 11 total pieces, right? Like, literally, that's all that's been found in the years since this happened. And again, of those 11, only 3 have been confirmed to be part of this flame, and like 4 of them or 5 of them are rumored to be part of the plane, but not confirmed. That is insane to me. Like, this huge ass plane, I understand the ocean is fucking gigantic, but there's also been a gigantic search.
Interesting.
And included the seabed too, and for them
that
to
they were
not
able
find
to conclusively
literally
say
anything,
that
and for the only things to have been found
X-Men's
to be found on beaches
records matched up
like
with the crash.
Crazy.
That felt very
so,
final and conclusive to me.
I mean, I think that most people already thought that the plane had crashed in the Southern Indian Ocean. I think maybe at the time there were still maybe some people that were thinking either the plane was captured or it was like shut down. But okay, emergency landing on like a tiny isle in the middle of the ocean is one way harder and two way more uncommon than TV would make you think. And so already to me that would be implausible even from the get-go before they even found anything. But I understand how people might want to think that, like, oh, maybe my family member, you know, just like lived in an island happily ever after. Well, not even happily ever after, kind of miserably ever after, but at least they're alive, right? But like, no, I wouldn't think that. And so you're right. And so this piece of debris kind of confirms, well, this plane crashed. So, but the interesting thing though is, why did it crash? And so I think I'm going to get more into that. So yeah, flaps and other parts of the plane rumored to be part of this plane were found, and that ignited even more. What it did ignite was actually a search on beaches and coasts. Fun fact, when the flap around was first found, people back in 2015, people were like, oh shit, let's like search our beaches. And that's actually where more plane debris was found. So actually that did help. But that's that. Now, there was an investigation, obviously, very, very deep investigation into all of this, and they had a lot of international participation. As I mentioned earlier, at this point, France, the US, Australia, China, and Malaysia are all part of this. I don't know if Vietnam was part of it. I didn't like read that far into this, but I wouldn't be surprised. So there's a lot of countries that have a lot of kind of stake in this, not only because the plane potentially crossed over their airspace and or because debris has been found in these respective countries' shores, but also because these countries had provided radar information, which again compromised some of their security if not handled properly, and also just because I'm sure a lot of these countries were also using Boeing 777s for their flights and they want to know what the fuck's going on. So there's an investigation, and there's a lot of technical language here that isn't really that important. I think what's more important is what the outcome of this investigation was, not necessarily the process of it taking place. The process of it was, to put it plainly, long story short, very political, very controversial. There was a lot of criticism aimed at a number of different parties for how they were handling the investigation and the lack of information that they were seemingly adding to it. Like, some of the countries seemed to be less willing to really help, right? They were kind of just on this investigation committee to save face, but they weren't really doing shit. And so that's kind of the technical background for the investigation. But baby, the outcome of this. So something that they found that was really interesting was, you know how I mentioned handshakes earlier? So there are handshakes that take place on March 7th, which is the last logged date of this like plane existing and communicating with anyone. And there's basically what, like 10, 11? No, there are 9 handshakes that happen between aircrafts and ground stations or like control towers. And then there are 2 quote unquote log-on requests that are transmitted by the aircraft to the ground station or control tower, trying to access information. So basically, a log-on request is an airplane trying to log their location with ground control without actually having to communicate with ground control in case ground control is inaccessible or something is going on. They also happen when the pilot wants to log the plane's location, but they're not actually in the cockpit for some reason for like that minute or that second, or they're gonna be asleep while their co-pilot takes over or something. And so they will beforehand schedule a log-on request to take place at a certain time so that they're... It's like a whole fucking mess. So that their ground control will still like have some acknowledgement of the plane's location without the pilot having to actually like call ground control and be like, hello. So I'm getting too technical. Whatever. The point is that there were there were a bunch of acknowledgments between the plane and ground station in the lapse of like the last 6 hours that this plane, you know, was still communicating. And then there's like one last like request from ground station to communicate with the plane at 9:15 p.m. Sorry, that night, and the aircraft does not respond to that request. So, 6 hours we have of communication, and then at 9 p.m. nothing, and then, what was it, like six to eight hours later, this plane doesn't land in Beijing, nothing's happening, plane's declared missing. So, all of this is to say that since the aircraft didn't respond to this ping at 9:15, basically the investigation, I wanted to mention like the other like 6 hours of pings just to like make it clear that this plane was communicating with ground control for like close to 6 hours very consistently, and then something happens at 9:15, right? So at some point between 8:19 and 9:15, because 8:19 was the last actually reciprocated communication, 8:19 p.m. Between 8:19 p.m. and 9:15 p.m., the aircraft lost the ability to communicate with ground station, right? That's all we know. So there's basically an hour of, like, unknowability, I guess. So, first, what do you think so far?
Totally. So, just around the circumstances of it, I think that last communication, I'm also willing to bet that someone had to manually turn it off. Either someone had to manually turn it off, or the plane had to be incapacitated for that last communication not to be received. So I think the interesting thing with so much of this is how much of it is manual, right? When we're talking about communications, when we're talking about like the change in direction that the plane took, those things all had to have a human behind them, because the plane isn't just going to take this weird direction. And it's also not going to, I assume, do these, like, auto updates and then suddenly stop them unless someone intervenes. So the real question, of course, is who and why. I mean, that's what I'm wondering, and I'm sure we're getting into it, but...
We are. So basically, and feel free to interrupt me at any moment, because I'm basically getting into theory territory now. The speculation here is that, again, between 8:19 and 9:15, that's when shit hits the fan, right? And there's a number of speculated causes for the disappearance of this plane. The first one is that there was passenger involvement, and you mentioned this earlier. There were two passengers on the plane that were later found to have been to have boarded the plane with fake passports. However, it was later concluded that these passengers had actually done that because they were seeking asylum. So
it's not like they let me take on a false identity to hijack this plane. They were like, let me take on a false identity to get to a safe country. Woo!
Yeah. So very no different. Nefarious yeah. purposes, and they weren't linked to any terrorist organizations, so nothing there. At least to me, there's really nothing there. Then there's a theory of crew involvement, right? So basically, bitch, either the pilot or the co-pilot did it, which I'll just say it now. I think it was the pilot.
I lean towards the pilot, but it's just... It's bizarre. Hard to know. Yeah, it's bizarre. It really is.
I mean, yeah, that's the most likely to me, but I'm not like completely set. And there's a couple reasons why. But basically, the crew involvement theory says that, and this is what most U.S. officials believe, which is interesting that not all of the involved countries kind of fall on this conclusion the most, but the U.S. does. They're like, we think the pilot did it, or at least the pilot had some involvement. But basically, the theory is that there's a number of theories on crew involvement, but the one that I like the most is that the pilot locked the co-pilot out of the cockpit at some point within that hour, and then there are, I failed to mention this, but there are logged the height at which the plane flies at all times is logged and sent to ground control, and the ground control found after the plane's disappearance that the plane had very erratic movements, very erratic changes in its like flight height, and one of them indicated that possible hypoxia may have taken place. And that means, like, if there's a very fast drop, or a very fast, like, rise that the plane makes, and we're talking thousands of feet in, like, I don't know, a number of seconds or a minute, that can fuck with your oxygen, basically, and you can't breathe very well, and you faint. Mm-hmm. And that's hypoxia. It's lack of oxygen to the brain. And so the theory here, at least the one that I like about crew involvement, is that the pilot locked the co-pilot out of the cockpit, and then he intentionally dropped the plane and or raised it, and disabled the mask for anyone outside of the cockpit. So he was wearing his mask, but everyone else wasn't, because he disabled them, which apparently is a thing that you can do from the cockpit. I would think it's just automatic, because planes would want to, you know, like, avoid situations like this where, like, pilots, you know, become terrorists. But I guess it's a thing that you can control from the cockpit, so never mind. And at that point, the co-pilot also faints. There's no one that can stop the captain from turning the plane around and basically heading down to the South Indian Ocean, waiting till the plane runs out of fuel and then just crashing and dying it. But there's a number of problems with that. One, why? Two, why not just crash the thing as soon as you can instead of waiting for the plane to run out of fuel? Like, you know, because if you're waiting, if you're waiting 6 hours for the plane to run out of fuel, which is, like, seemingly what the plane had left of fuel, right? After it stops communicating, had about 5 to 6 hours left of fuel. That gives other things and places so many opportunities to contact you or see you or locate you. And why not just crash the thing immediately? So that's weird. And three, this guy, the official investigation report noted that he didn't have any recent changes in, like, his family or, like, relationships or, like, alcohol and drug abuse, like, nothing like that. He was not struggling with any mental health issues at the time. So
totally. Well, it's interesting because people report differently on that too. But
oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have a source or two that talks about other issues in his life, but I feel like the most I mean, it's mainly, like, news sources, like the New York Post and stuff, but I really do feel like it's just interesting that people could report differently on something like that. I feel like the official investigations have more often come up with that he didn't have any serious changes in mood, though, which I'm more likely to trust.
But I mean, if you have something else, share it, because the official investigations are also the ones that have been criticized for leaving out some crucial information that was later found to have been left out. So as far as we know, maybe they're unreliable about his character as well.
Totally, totally. Well, one piece of crucial data is that, as I mentioned, a lot of the turns that happened, like, right until the plane crashed, were really abnormal and had to have occurred because of a person who was in control of the plane. So, and there's also the other question of, if these abnormal turns are intentional, there's only so many people on the plane who even know how to turn a plane that way, right? Pilot, mm-hmm. co-pilot, mm-hmm. maybe someone else has taken a flight class. But that's a big one. Yeah, I do have a source, though, that says that he was depressed closer to the flight, and also that this is an interesting one, because it just came out in 2019. But apparently some of the pilot's friends had told a specialist that he had become obsessed with a couple of young models he'd seen online, and his wife left him. I actually don't understand, though, how... Because that's what I'm saying. This article is saying that Zahari's marriage was bad, and that he had slept with flight attendants in the past. But that sounds really directly opposed to some of the other stuff. I don't know. I'll leave this to the listeners. New York Post, I wouldn't say, is the most dependable. I think this might just be sensationalized. <It is not.
laughs> I mean, it could be true. Maybe the official investigation report, since it was heavily influenced by Malaysian authorities, and this guy was Malaysian, and the flight was from Malaysian Airlines. Maybe they were trying to, you know, keep things squeaky clean, and they covered that up, and they lied, and they said, no, his life was totally fine. Maybe it's true, but even if it's true, I mean, I mean, I guess I don't know. I guess you can become depressed enough if your wife leaves you that given that you're a pilot, you decide this is how I'm going to take it on in the world. I'm just going to fucking, you know, crash this plane. But again, he didn't crash it. He just waited for the thing to run out of fuel. And so that's weird. But thank you for that note. However, something that is very something that really is very sus is this that I failed to mention. They looked at this guy's house, right? So mm-hmm. they searched the pilot's house.
Oh, is this the simulation?
Yeah, which yeah, is part of the it's yeah, part of the crew totally. Involvement theory.
Totally.
They
totally.
Found that this guy had a flight simulator in his home, which isn't strange. I mean, he's a pilot. Like, that makes sense, I guess. A flight simulator is kind of like, I mean, it's literally like this like fake cockpit that you get into and you pretend that you're in a plane. It's like a video game, but it's also like used for real and like official like training for pilots. So it's like, you know, it's like a video game, but like serious video game. You know, like you're actually training as if you were flying a plane for real. And what that allows you to do is, you know, become a trained pilot before you ever even fly your first plane. However, what it also allows you to do is, in the case of this flight, potentially plan a route without having ever flown it before, plan a route and premeditate a plane disappearance. So when authorities searched this guy's house and found the flight simulator, they searched they looked at the fucking game, they searched the software for any weird shit, and they found logged a flight path on this simulator that was very similar, and I mean eerily similar, to the flight path that authorities think 370 took the day it disappeared. And yeah, I mean, that's I don't like that. I mean, listen, there's one caveat, right? There's one caveat. Like, this flight path was reconstructed for a number of logs that this software had in it, and these logs consisted of 7 different coordinate points, that 2 were in Kuala Lumpur, 2 were like left of Kuala Lumpur all the way in like in the middle of the ocean, and then 3 of them were down in the South Indian Ocean. And if you've seen the map, Sunny, which I know you have, basically this looks like an inverted L, right? And that's again what the alleged flight path that 370 took looks like. And so they're like, fucking checkmate, he did it, we found this thing. However, the thing with these software logs is that they are, again, 7 coordinate points that are just locked in there, but they have no way of knowing if these 7 coordinate points were locked during the same flight, during the same simulated flight, right? Like, all they know is that the most recent locks of the software contain these 7 coordinate points, not that these 7 coordinate points were all flown in the flight simulator on one flight. They don't know that.
So they don't actually know that they're all connected in the same path that the plane took.
Yeah, for all we know, the guy maybe was, you know, simulating the last couple times he used a simulator, he was simulating 2 or 3 different things. You know, maybe he was simulating a flight from Kuala Lumpur to the middle of the ocean, which is still very suspicious. and or a flight from you know, Kuala Lumpur to the like very South Indian Ocean or back. Again, all we have are 7 coordinate points that we decided to connect the dots for, but we don't actually know if they were meant to be connected like that and all at once. So but again, like I said, it's still very sus if you were simulating a flight from, let's say, the middle of the ocean to the middle of the ocean. So, I mean, I still like the pilot theory. It's very suspicious. The co-pilot, I have nothing on. He's very unsuspicious. If anything, it seems to me that, remember when I mentioned the iPhone? This guy had an iPhone 5S, the co-pilot. And apparently there was some people think that it was a phone call. This is wrong. There was a location log that went out from his phone to like there was like a Find My iPhone ping basically that authorities somehow got a hold of, and that helped them initially like try like to track the alleged like flight path. Part of what helped them do that again was this guy's like location ping that was sent out from his phone at one random point. And some people think initially they thought that like what they actually had found on his phone was, or like, they, yeah, what they had actually found was that this guy had tried to make a phone call, but that's not what they found. But if they had, that would have really aided this theory, because imagine it, you get locked out of your cockpit, you're the co-pilot, you try to make a phone call, which I don't know if it works, like, if you're on a plane, but, and, you know, and it, like, doesn't go through, but somehow a tower, a cell tower, still gets, like, the log, like, mm-hmm. the attempt log or something. That's pretty spooky, but it wasn't quite that, unfortunately. However, I still think the pilot did it. That's it.
Totally. And, I mean, I lean towards that, too. But there are a couple of other interesting theories, if you're down to hear some.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
One that I thought was interesting is that South Korea noted that North Korea nearly took out a Chinese plane that had 220 passengers on March 5th, 2014, so a couple days before this flight. So some have come up with the theory that folks in North Korea either shot the plane down or hijacked it and diverted it into North Korea. I think that's an interesting one. There's some other government-related ones.
But why, though? Like, why would North Korea want to do that?
I think it's because of, like, North Korea-China tensions.
Well, if anything, China's, like, one of their only friends left in the world. I mean, I'd understand it if it was maybe an American airline, but I just don't see that. Sorry.
I guess, I don't know, though. I think I'd have to look it up, but I'm not sure about China and North Korea's relationship right now, because I feel like everything's very tense in general there, because North Korea, yeah, there's, East Asian tensions are high, but okay. There's also some who fear that the Russian President Vladimir Putin was involved. This is a science writer, Jeff Wise, and he claims that Putin spoofed the plane's navigation data so it could fly unnoticed into Cosmodrome so he could quote-unquote hurt the West. That one I feel much less strongly about because it's mainly a flight with Chinese citizens. Also, to my knowledge, Russia and China are allies, and I'm not sure how Putin could be hurting the West through, or why he would want to hurt the West through this particular flight. But it's out there. And of course there's the claim that this could have been essentially a suicide by the pilot, which is kind of what we've been talking about. But it's interesting, even when you talk about what happened, you could think of it as a, I mean, here's the thing. If the pilot of this airplane were a 14-year-old white boy in the US, would we have any doubt? Who had been bullied growing up or something. I'm talking school shooter type. Would we have any doubt about
that? Well, girl, a 14-year-old wouldn't be piloting a fucking Boeing.
No, exactly. I guess my point is just that it's wild how much of this mystery comes down to what was the state of mind of the pilot. Because it's just this one person that we just don't know anything about. It's a different cultural context, too. But yes, there are some theories around what you mentioned earlier, Andre, with him essentially killing everyone on the flight and then crashing it. It's like a murder-suicide. And there's also a theory about cracks in the plane. Apparently, Malaysia Airlines found a 15-inch crack in the fuselage of one of its planes a few days before the MH370 disappeared. The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, issued a final warning about that 2 days before the disappearance of this plane. So it should have been taken care of, but there are theories around, like, maybe the antenna was not the same, so it didn't receive the warning, and that problem with it wasn't fixed. That one is interesting, but I think, again, just the change in direction of the plane seems very intentional, so I'm not
sure.
It's
very erratic. Exactly. It's very sudden, it's very much intentional. You were talking earlier about automatic versus manual controls, and some people theorize that, well, a lot of autopilot may have been used in the now, you know, like, rerouted plane flight route, that the turn is definitely, because it's such a sharp left turn, the turn is definitely one thing that could not have been done by autopilot. And so it was definitely the pilot who did it. The only question left there is why. And that, but obviously that's still the most crucial question.
What if I love someone had like a weapon at his head? But yeah?
Yeah, exactly. I love that you mentioned like China and Russia and North Korea, because I mean, I don't buy these, but obviously there have been theories, not only the ones that you mentioned, but that a number of countries could have shut down this plane on purpose for some I guess, like, reason, and there was a huge cover-up, including debris planted across a number of beaches, which is just a load of shit to me. That's not what happened here. But, it, you know, there are theories like that. I did fail to mention that there is a fire on the plane theory, which is basically a lot of the cargo of this plane was lithium ion batteries, and those actually were known to cause a fire in a previous flight. Not this airline, but like this has happened in the past, that like lithium ion batteries have caught on fire in a plane. Something about how they're made of, like, or like loss of like cabin pressure or something, and they catch fire, and then the plane has to do an emergency landing, which, like, okay, let's pretend that this is what happened. There was no emergency landing attempted. Now, there is another caveat to that caveat, which is that no emergency landing could have been attempted even as the, you know, plane turned around and was flying over land, because the communications were turned off. And assuming that they were turned off not on purpose, but because something happened to the plane, then the poor pilot had no way of communicating to any tower. And how the fuck are you going to land a plane? Just anywhere, you know? You know, and so maybe everyone here had good intentions. Maybe there was just a fucking fire in the plane. They tried to do an emergency landing, but by the time they tried to do that, for some reason, the comms weren't working. And so the pilot just decided to keep flying on the ocean. That makes no sense, though. Yeah.
And that is Malaysian Flight 370.
Yeps. Yeah. Thank you for cutting me off, because I could keep going forever. Actually, I will for another 2 minutes, because I can't leave this episode without going over this. Okay. Bitch aliens, listen. Listen, okay? Listen.
Why is it always aliens with you, Andre?
Welcome to Scary Talk. So, there's one last theory, which I read in my own head, because I made it up, which is that the reason this motherfucker turned the plane was because he encountered something out of this world at some point. Well, at that point, rather. And was like, nope. Went the fuck back. And okay, that explains the turn. Again, unfortunately, I want to mention this because I have to mention this, right? Aliens. Unfortunately, that doesn't explain, again,
why he would just fly into the Indian Ocean.
Fly into the Indian Ocean. Not only, like, oh my god. Because you guys really need to look at a map, but, like, before the Indian Ocean, I need to look at a map because I'm fucking stupid, but, okay, so this guy is, again, going from he's going from, like, westernmost Malaysia, across Malaysia, to the right, to the South China Sea, and then does a sharp left turn back to Malaysia, through all of Malaysia, comes out through the left of Malaysia, so he's already gone as far back as where the plane started from to begin with. So now it's like a 90 degree angle at this point, right? And then keeps going left into the Indian Ocean, like way into the ocean where there's no land under the plane. And so the alien theory, unfortunately, explains the turn that maybe this guy saw something in the South China Sea and was like, nope, sharp left turn back home. But it doesn't explain why they just kept flying into the ocean. Again, even if he saw something and he was like, I'm going back home and I'm going to try an emergency landing, even if he was unsuccessful at doing that, again, like I mentioned, it still doesn't explain why he would do this. So
that's the initial fear would be explained, but okay.
Precisely.
Okay.
So
okay.
It really sounds like maybe the pilot had some nefarious purposes, which really sucks. It would really suck also if, like, 10 years down the line we found out that, like, it wasn't the pilot at all, and here we are, like, trashing the pilot.
No, but, well, that's the thing. He, when you see, like, videos of him, there's also, like, I think he put out, like, helpful YouTube videos and stuff at one point. Uh-huh. He just seems like this very mellow dude. It's really hard to believe. So,
well, so did Jeffrey Dahmer. So,
I mean, yeah, yeah. But that's
it.
There we go. Mystery solved, thanks to...
I don't know about you, Sunny, but I'm really liking these episodes where we cover one big mystery rather than each of us covering different mysteries, because I think we were able to give a much more comprehensive understanding of one, you know, one big thing. Or even if it's not very big, we get to get really in depth into one thing instead of surface level for many things.
I do agree. And it's fun.
I think that we should continue, and I think that if our listeners have any ideas for future mysteries that they'd like us to cover, our ears are very much open. I will tell you, Sunny, I don't know about you listeners, but I am very interested in the lost colony of Roanoke. So maybe that's coming. That's a big one.
Okay.
She really said, okay. Okay, everyone. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Remember that you can find us everywhere and shit. Send us stuff and cute memes and ideas at TalkScary on Instagram and Twitter, and at ScaryTalk on Facebook. Sunny, anything else to add?
Thank you so much for listening, you all.
Yep. Don't get on a plane ever again. And we love you. Good night.
Good night.